Thank you very much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And today we welcome back Tom Plager, Dean and Campus Executive Officer and Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County. Really pleased to have Dean Plager back to talk with us about the archaeology and anthropology of Wisconsin as it relates to our native tribes. And I had a great first in the series with him a few weeks back, and he's here for the second. The first, we talked about the first residents in Wisconsin. Today, we're going to zero in on what is called the archaic Indian tradition in Wisconsin from about 8,000 BC to 400 BC. And we certainly invite your questions and comments as we move along today. If you're in no matter where you are in the state, as a matter of fact, you can call us at our 800 number, which is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like to email us, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Dean Plager, welcome back.
Welcome, or thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk about Wisconsin archaeology.
Did you have any reaction to your first program here?
We did. We had quite a number of emails and some follow-up telephone calls. A number of individuals that sent me JPEGs, images of artifacts that they discovered around the state, including a few that were significant that I've passed on to the state archaeologist's office, and some things in our area in Sauk County we'll need to follow up on. But that's one of the great things about this type of format is allows people that have discovered materials to connect with professional archaeologists and for the professional community to learn even more about the prehistory of our region.
Well, last time we talked about the first residents, but now we want to talk about the archaic Indian tradition. How do you define archaic in Wisconsin?
Well, last time, as you mentioned, we focused on Paleo-Indians, and that's an artificial construct or name that's given to the very first, almost the pioneer, so to speak, of Wisconsin.
Right.
And archaic is the term that is conceptualized that refers to the immediate early Holocene, mid-Holocene, end of the Ice Age, up to about 500, 400 BC cultures that were hunter-gatherers. Larger populations on the landscape than the preceding Paleo-Indian tradition, mobile people that moved probably from location to location following seasonal resources as they became available and in high yield. And again, this is pre-bow and arrow technology, pre-mound construction, pre-ceramics, pre-agriculture. So we're still talking about very small populations, particularly as the archaic tradition began. And it's divided into three stages, the early, middle, and late. And these are recognized by formal changes in cultural practices that show up in the archaeological record, changes in weaponry, changes in the types of burials and the patterns that we see as archaeologists that allow us to apply those names. And again, no one called themselves an archaic Indian. It's an artificial construct or a taxon created by archaeologists to make sense of the past.
So what kind of evidence do we have for recognizing that early archaic stage?
Well, it's somewhat of a mystery in our state. When we talked about Paleo-Indian last time, these are a series of cultures, Paleo-Indians, that existed right at the end of the Ice Age in our region. And that transition from the end of the Ice Age, the end of the Pleistocene, to the early Holocene is one where we don't have a lot of archaeology in the state. And it may represent either a potential depopulation or potentially our inability to recognize this transition from Paleo-Indian to early archaic. We do have a few sites from this early 6,000s to 7,000s BC range, one in particular, the Bass site in Grant County that was excavated by UW-Madison's emeritus professor, now emeritus professor of anthropology, Jim Stoltman, in the 70s, where we had a large distribution of lithic stone material of Galena chert, where hunter-gatherers this early archaic stage were there retooling and manufacturing new tools and seemed to be focused on that chert resource, which was critical to manufacture tools and survive in this environment. Other than that site, there are only a handful of others where we have some radiocarbon dates. There's some recent research that's been done in the Door Peninsula connected with highway archaeology by Jim Clark that's going to shed some light on what we know about the northeastern part of the state. But there's a real absence of information of this very earliest part of the stage. Things really pick up in the 4 and 5,000s BC range where we have significant more sites and the first large-scale cemeteries on the landscape that tell us people are staying within a particular region for a longer period of time.
And I wanted to ask you about maybe you could speculate a little bit about what life was like for those early folks. There was before bow and arrow, for example. How did they capture their game and so forth?
Well, again, this is, all of the archaic cultures that we're talking about are post-glacial and into what we call early and middle Holocene, which is the environment that we're or the epoch that we're in today. So we begin to see the appearance of species that we're familiar with. We know from a series of rock shelter sites, overhang sites in the south central and southwestern part of the state that have been excavated, that these people were focused on a variety of resources, but really ate a wider variety of things than Paleo-Indians. We have the first evidence of nut consumption, plant consumption, tools for processing nuts and other plant material. White-tailed deer was a major part of the diet, probably other small game, squirrel, and a variety of small mammals, as well as the first evidence of intensive fishing. And the pattern seems to be, it changes throughout this time period, seems to be people taking advantage of high-yield resources when they're very abundant. For example, acorns, something that most people aren't familiar with eating today. They're very unpleasant if you bite into one. But if they're processed properly, they are a very nutritious food and they can be stored. If you think about when are those available, high yields in the fall where people could gather nuts, store them. You think of certain fish species that are spawning in high frequency at certain times of the year, that people moved to a resource, extracted as much as possible, and then moved within probably a cyclical pattern within a territory to take advantage of those resources as they change throughout the year.
Interesting. Well, we have some callers online. If you'd like to join in, by the way, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Ken in Oshkosh, we'll turn to you now. Ken, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Back in 76, I was doing research in the Revolutionary War, and I came across a reference work which mentioned a expedition sent out by Washington to the West because of the problems he foresaw as possible with the Indians. And they described, in fact, they named it probably as Fond du Lac as the last determinative reference point, a large freshwater lake, but not one of the Great Lakes. And they then headed northwest from that foot of the lake, and they found a group of three-story structures made of wood, a fairly comprehensive city for the time period. And all along the route, they always found everything deserted. In other words, the Indians knew they were coming, and they essentially left the area. But I'm just wondering if the Archaeological Association has ever found anything of that nature in the Berlin area.
Well, this is dealing with much later in time than what we're covering today, and there are European accounts and archaeological evidence to demonstrate significant native village structures here at European contact in the 1600s, 1700s. And as we move later in time, we'll spend a particular segment on historic contact and the impact of European cultures on native peoples and the depopulations that took place, but that's really outside of the time frame that we're talking about today.
Yeah, so we will get to that, Ken. So
I appreciate the question.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. The middle archaic stage, which is from 5,000 to 1,700 BC, that there were several new technologies that came along in that period, were there not?
Well, we start to see the development of groundstone tools, and most of the artifacts that we've talked about on this program and the previous program have been flake stone. Grinding stone tools include axes, adzes, woodworking tools, chisels, gouges, plant processing tools, and those make those first appearances. And those are heavy types of tools, not the types of thing that you'd want to carry two or three in a backpack around with you. So people are starting to stay within a region or a territory probably for longer periods of time, extensive woodworking, along with the development of metal technology. And that's an area that I've done quite a bit of research on. The term old copper industry or old copper complex refers to the best known series or best studied or most studied of archaic cultures in this middle archaic stage. Starting about 4,000 BC, native peoples began to mine copper in the Great Lakes as well as collect copper nuggets, and through hot and cold hammering and grinding, fabricate a variety of tools. And when Europeans first encountered these things, this heavy tool manufacturing ended probably around 500 BC or so, when Europeans and farmers and explorers in Wisconsin came in contact with these things. If you read the early literature, historians, archaeologists thought that they weren't Native American because Native people weren't thought to use extensive metal technology in our region. Today we know that one of the oldest metal technologies in the Americas is centered right here in the state of Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and the Lake Superior Basin, that allowed people to produce a whole variety of tools and use a technology that previously was not available to Native peoples.
And talk a bit about those tools made out of copper.
Nearly pure copper. If you travel up to the Upper Peninsula, the Keweenaw Peninsula, Isle Royale, you could still visit prehistoric Indian mining sites of shafts cut into the bedrock where people mined this copper. The other major source was drift copper that occurred in glacial outwash gravel beds. Whole variety of tools were made, and you can see thousands of them here at the Wisconsin Historical Society in the Hamilton Collection. There's one of the largest collections that's been amassed of these types of tools, all kinds of projectile points, some of which have sockets similar to bayonets, woodworking awls, needles, and very complex fishing gear. One particular type of tool I've spent some time studying are toggle head harpoons. These are conical-shaped rolled cones of copper with a barb on the end that would have been placed loosely on a wooden shaft. There's a hole usually in the middle of this fishing harpoon point with a lanyard attached to it, and it would allow someone to spear a fish, pull the shaft out, and pull on this line, and the thing would spin sideways in a large fish. And the type of tool you would need for harvesting large sturgeon, northern pike, large catfish that allowed a resource that previously was not nearly as accessible for Native peoples once these types of fishing tools were developed.
That's amazing. We have a lot of, and we have access to those at the Historical Society.
Great collections of copper materials at the Wisconsin Historical Society, Milwaukee Public Museum, the Neville Public Museum, the Weiss Earth Science Museum at the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley has an outstanding prehistoric mining exhibit. These are all places that you can go and see these tools. Thousands of them have been found in Wisconsin. The vast majority were found as surface finds until in the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s, a series of cemetery sites were excavated that shed a tremendous amount of new information on the people that produced these tools.
You wonder, and as I often wonder about some new innovation or new discovery, you wonder how copper came to be discovered and used.
Well, I can give some possibility as to how that scenario probably played out. As we talked about Paleo-Indian peoples, these were, and even early archaic cultures, these were people that depended upon geological resources for survival on our landscape. Probably the single most important resource was to find materials that you could make tools out of. And stone tools, the right type of stone, not every stone works well for making flake stone tools, the types of things that Native peoples would have had an eye out for. They would have had to understand the geology and where you would find the type of rock that is suitable for making stone tools. So it's not a surprise that in that context that hunter-gatherers would have stumbled across this green metal and found out that when you hammer it or hit it, it doesn't flake, but it contracts and expands and has properties to it that are very unique compared to stone.
Yeah, really interesting. Tom Plager, our guest today, Dean and Campus Executive Officer, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW Baraboo Sauk County campus, as we talk with him about the archaic Indian traditions in Wisconsin. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network. If you'd like to join in our conversation today as we talk about the archaic Indian tradition in Wisconsin, about 8,000 B.C. to about 400 B.C., with Dean Tom Plager of the UW Baraboo Sauk County campus, I hope you'll join in. The number again, 1-800-642-1234, or email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to George in Columbus next. Hi,
yes,
George.
Hello. About 40 years ago, I ran across a couple of monographs about bird stones and banner stones, and I've never heard about them since then. Could you say something about that? What are they? What were they used for, and what period do they represent?
Sure. What the caller is referring to are a type of ground stone implement or tool that's usually made out of banded slate, other types of slates, and they are thought to be spear thrower at lateral weights. They are generally items that are finely polished and crafted. Some of them, the term birdstone applies to forms that are avian in form that have a bird-like appearance. They often have holes drilled at various angles that appear to be the attachment, again, as a spear thrower weight. The peoples that produce these things are primarily late archaic, and we're talking probably, if I estimate the range of most of these artifacts, are in the maybe 1700 to 500 BC range in our region. The people that produce these tools were not using bow and arrow technology, but had elaborate probably dart and spear thrower technology. And these particular artifacts are very rare in terms of being discovered in archaeological contexts. We're likely some type of a spear thrower weight that added momentum or force to throwing the spear.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks, George. Appreciate your call. We have an email from someone, Robert, who wonders whether you could touch on the effects of altithermal climate regime to archaic cultures and the environment, such as water levels in Green Bay and how might this be a lesson for the current global warming discussions?
A very interesting question. As I mentioned, the archaic tradition existed in early and mid-Holocene times, and it was a period of significant climatic change in the region. The altithermal refers to a time frame in the archaic, or really a climatic event, where we see conditions that are different than today. It's thought that during early archaic times, with some of the pollen evidence, that pollen often, if it falls into a lake and gets trapped in sediment, well, it can be preserved for thousands of years. And climatologists and geomorphologists that have tried to reconstruct the climate in prehistoric Wisconsin have extracted these pollens, and we get some idea of the changes of plant life. And we can see that from data from Devil's Lake, from the lakes in the Madison area, from the southern part of the state, that during early archaic times there appeared to be a cooler, probably a fairly heavy deciduous forest across much of the state. By middle and archaic times, we begin to see a warming and drying that changed the vegetation and probably allowed for a greater consumption of white-tailed deer, probably not the numbers that we see today with the advent of corn agriculture and widespread clearing of the landscape. There are probably a lot more deer on the landscape than there were during the time that prehistoric peoples were here. So we have changes in the ecology. In the vegetation and the flora and fauna, all modern species, but different forests and different types of vegetation than perhaps in areas that we're familiar with today if we visited those locations in the past. And then the other major significant change are lake levels. When we talked last time, when Paleo Indians arrived, the northern portion of the state was still covered by ice. The upper Great Lakes were dammed and filled with ice. As the ice age ended and these sheets melted, the lake drainage systems reversed direction. We have isostatic rebound of the great weight from the ice masses in the northern part of the state and the upper Great Lakes. Once that ice melted away, the landscape has continuously been lifting or rising. And the lake levels have fluctuated dramatically. I'm from Marinette originally, and people are concerned about how lake levels have shifted over the last 20 years or so. Green Bay and Lake Michigan probably during early archaic times was at least 100 to 150 feet vertically lower than it is today. And so many of the archaeological sites dating to the early archaic stage are likely inundated. And then there were periods of time during the middle archaic when Lake Michigan was perhaps as much as 20 vertical feet higher than it is today. And one of the things that archaeologists are very interested in, a number of colleagues of mine, John Anderton working in the Upper Peninsula, myself working in the northeast part of the state, Bill Lovis in Michigan, are looking at the relationship of these ancient shorelines, which you can trace out on quadrangle maps, and looking at the archaeology on these shorelines, and there's generally a pattern in terms of age of the oldest sites relating to when those geological features formed in relation to changing lake levels.
So has there been any archaeological work done then on the floor of Lake Michigan?
Well, there have been some discoveries when the lakes lake levels move up and down, and again, we have seen in the last 20 years perhaps 4 or 5, maybe more vertical feet changes in elevation. One of the things that we have seen in this lower lake levels is a significant amount of archaeology discovered along the coastline and of our Great Lakes. In particular, these old copper sites are easy to identify through metal detecting, and it's actually become somewhat of a problem for archaeologists and for the preservation of the state because it's so easy to discover these types of things. And there are some metal detectorists that work very well with professional archaeologists that report information and help us identify these new sites that had previously been inundated. But there are others that are out collecting on public lands, and that really is illegal and damaging to the resource. I can't emphasize enough that archaeological resources are non-renewable. We have only so many archaeological sites in the state. And again, you have to think about these things as the analogy of being similar to crime scenes, and that the position of the artifacts, even if today they may have been underwater, their positioning and association, if properly documented and recovered by professionals and reported, can give us tremendous insight. Once things are picked up and the locational information is lost, they're really of no value to the professional archaeologist in terms of yielding information about these cultures.
Hmm. Well, Eric in Fitchburg, we give you a chance now. Hi, Eric. Thank you for calling.
I was wondering about bronze. Like, did they have it? When did they come up with it? And who figured out how to mix it?
Good question. No bronze, no alloy or molten metal technology in prehistoric Eastern North America. Unlike other areas of the world, particularly Southeast Asia, ancient Turkey, some areas of Africa, in those areas, metal technology often occurred after ceramic technology. So people were already experimenting with kilns and high temperature firing of materials. In Eastern North America and the Great Lakes region, our metal technology, our earliest metal technology in the context of the archaic tradition, occurred in some cases several thousand years before anyone was experimenting with firing clays. And so native people did not develop a technology to melt metal or to alloy it, which in the case of bronze is a mixture of tin or tin, lead, arsenic, and copper, depending upon what the components are of the alloy in bronze. But that never took place here. And as I mentioned early on when we started this discussion, when early American historians and archaeologists looked at these thousands of often green color oxidized copper tools from Wisconsin, if you read the very early literature prior to, let's say, 1870, people thought that these tools were bronze and thought that they were probably of European antiquity and somehow predated Native Americans. Today we know that they are in fact made by Native peoples and are made using a hot and cold hammering technology.
Hmm.
Good
so
question.
What do you think the earliest year was?
Well, there is no bronze technology here in Eastern North America. The development of bronze in Europe and in Asia occurred in a similar time frame during middle Holocene times, but that never occurred here in Eastern North America.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Oh, and Larry?
Yes.
When's my favorite guy going to be on again? Phil Pelletieri.
Oh, Phil Pelletieri? I don't know. I'll think about it, Eric, and we'll try and come up with a time. Probably about another 3 weeks, it'd be my guess. He comes by about once a month. And he was on, I think, about a week ago. So it's probably about another 3 weeks down the road, Eric. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. If you'd like to join in, it's easy to get on. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, email area, you can email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We used to have a separate number for Madison and then the rest of the state, and so after 20 years or so of saying both the Madison number and the state number, that still pops into my brain once in a while. Anyway, it's 1-800-642-1234. This old copper industry, Where does that name come from, by the way?
Well, if you look back in the literature, an archaeologist, very famous archaeologist by the name of Will C. McKern, who was at the Milwaukee Public Museum, did a significant amount of archaeology in the 20s, 30s, 40s in Wisconsin, came up with the term. And he based it upon the fact that his excavations, when these types of tools were recovered or when they were found by collectors, often didn't occur with mound construction, didn't occur with ceramics. So he coined the term old or ancient copper industry or technology. It's probably a series of cultures rather than one specific people, and it endured for 7,000 or several thousand years. But he was correct in terms of his understanding once radiocarbon dating was developed and a number of stratified archaeological sites and these mortuary or burial sites that were discovered in the 40s and 50s and 60s were excavated, the time range became apparent and the resolution increased. So we now know most of these copper tools, these heavy socketed tools, were made from about 4,000 BC to 1,000 BC.
All right. Herb in Washburn County, we're on to you now. Hi, Herb.
Hi, I'd just like to talk about the ancient copper mining. You know, the source is usually considered to be Isle Royale in the UP, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Now we know today that ancient mining did take place here in Wisconsin. Up here in the northwest part of the state, in Douglas County, there's an old mine site called the Weyerhaeuser Mine. And samples were collected there in 1988, and they were tested using a neutron activation analysis, I believe it's called. And that enables them to give a trace element fingerprint for every individual mine site or loader deposit. Well, anyway, they were able to trace some prehistoric copper artifacts back to that site in Wisconsin, in Douglas County. And some of these artifacts came from Minnesota and Quebec, and Massachusetts, Maine, and Vermont.
Comment, Dean Pleasure?
Sure. There's been a lot of research done on this, and the caller is correct. The University of Toronto, in particular, their archaeochemistry laboratories have been working on fingerprinting copper deposits in the Great Lakes, and not only in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ontario, the Keweenaw. And we know that there are, I mentioned the Keweenaw Peninsula, there are thousands of mines across the Great Lakes, particularly the Lake Superior Basin. And this research, as correctly was pointed out by the caller, has allowed for chemical fingerprints that allow one to identify the specific geology, the chemical composition of a copper from one deposit from one location, and then look at and sample prehistoric artifacts and get some idea of the distance from the source of the metal that people move these items. Mm-hmm. Now, what complicates this is the other major deposit, which may have produced equally as much or even more copper than the mining sources, are all the gravel outwash beds across glaciated Wisconsin, the glaciated Great Lakes, where the glacier deposited gravels mixed along with copper nuggets. And you can go out to gravel quarries in eastern Wisconsin today, and if you stop and talk to a quarry operator, they most often will have several pieces of copper that have gotten stuck in their crusher. And this was an extensive source for native peoples as well. But it's fascinating research. It gives us some idea of the movement of these materials. And I should point out that these copper tools are found all the way from the eastern plains to the Atlantic coast in the northeastern part of the state. The core area where the largest concentration is Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Ontario. But we know that during middle and late archaic times, people were trading and in contact with groups over a very wide area. A couple of sites in Wisconsin, one in particular, a late archaic site by the name of Riverside, excavated by Bob Hrushka, actually right across from Marinette in Menominee County, Michigan, technically in Michigan, produced evidence of significant long-distance trade. Marine shell beads, certain types of material from the Ohio River Valley, flake stone from the Dakotas, and a block of obsidian that's been chemically fingerprinted from the Yellowstone area. Wow. That arrived in our state probably somewhere around 800 to 400 or 500 BC during late archaic times, and it's volcanic glass. So that tells you just how extensive people had contact with one another across a very a large area covering the eastern plains all the way to the Atlantic coast and also to the Gulf Coast of Mexico.
How big was that block? How much did it weigh?
In about 3 pounds, 1.5 kilograms. So, but that's one of the largest pieces of obsidian that's been found outside of Paleo-Indian context. When it was discovered, the archaeologists at the University of Michigan thought that it was probably later in time and couldn't date to this early the earlier time period in terms of belonging to the Archaic. Some of the research that I've done, where we've been able to go back and look at the artifacts associated from these burial sites with the tools. In this case, there was some preserved hide and birch bark that we were able to radiocarbon date that came back in the 800s to 500s BC. So it tells us 2,800 years ago in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a stone's throw from Marinette, Wisconsin, that someone could secure an object as far away from as Yellowstone. And remember, this is without horses. Would have had to have been transported in someone's either by walking or watercraft from person to person, group to group over a fairly significant distance.
Boy. Thanks, Herb, again for calling. Appreciate it. Jim and Madison, we're back to you now. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Earlier in the discussion, the guest listed places you could go to see the copper artifacts. And could he repeat the name of the museum that has the Indian mining display?
The Weiss Earth Science Museum at the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley in Menasha focuses on mining resources used by Europeans, but also Native American peoples. And there's an excellent exhibit there. Should also point out the old Copper Culture Cemetery State Park Museum is worth a visit. That's one of these early cemetery sites that was discovered in the 1950s, and there's a display there as well.
And it's located?
In Oconto, Wisconsin, just outside of Oconto, Wisconsin.
Okay, thank you much. I've been to the Oconto one. That is worth a visit.
Thank you very much for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Let's go to Paul in Madison. Paul, hello to you.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. It's a fascinating show.
Thank you.
And tell me, when is the first evidence of the tanning or curing of animal hides in this area? And I'll take my answer and off the phone.
Okay.
Great question. We have indirect evidence for hide utilization in Paleo-Indian times in the form of in the Great Plains bone needles that have been recovered that suggest the manipulation of hides for garments and the scraping tools that clearly show people were processing hides. Now, tanning, depending upon what type of tanning you're talking about, was probably at least rudimentary tanning was done very early on, the end of the Ice Age, where people were cleaning hides and preparing them or curing them. But when you're talking about modern tanning techniques that involve, in the case of, I think, chromium and other complex chemical mixes that are applied to the hides, that type of process probably obviously hadn't developed. But people were definitely, from the first entry point into our region, using animal hides for clothing, for tents, for dwellings, later on potentially involved in watercraft. And unfortunately, those are perishable materials and often don't survive. Some of these middle and late archaic cemetery sites, copper has, when it comes in contact with organic material like hide and wood, will preserve it. That green oxidized color makes the environment inhospitable to microorganisms. And occasionally we'll get preserved hide remnants. I think the oldest hide remnants that I know of probably date to middle and late archaic times in Wisconsin.
Thank you again for calling. Let's turn to Rick in Milwaukee. Rick, hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm wondering if you have any idea how large these native populations were back then, and were they concentrated? I don't know if you went in the early portion of the show. I missed.
Great question. It's difficult to estimate prehistoric populations. There are a variety of ways that you can do it. Look at the sizes of sites, the density of sites by county over the landscape, the size of mortuary or burial sites. And we have to, again, look at the archaic tradition as these series of stages of early, middle, and late. Early archaic populations seem to be very similar to Paleo-Indian, mobile hunter-gatherer groups, perhaps maybe 20 to 40 individuals. It's an estimate based on band-level societies from other cultures. By middle and late archaic times, we begin to see increases in populations. In the case of the middle archaic, a number of the old copper cemeteries are cemeteries that contain estimates of several hundred people that were buried there, and that would lead you to suspect that people are staying within a particular territory. We also have the first evidence of violence violence during middle and late archaic times. The Price Three site in Richland County, there's a stone projectile point embedded in the vertebrae of an individual, and the Convent Knoll and Riverside late archaic cemeteries have significant evidence of projectile points embedded in people, and in some cases even some dismemberment. So clearly by late archaic times, there's an increase in people clustered along river systems, lake systems, and there is clearly competition for resources in Wisconsin.
Well, someone else sent in an email wondering about books that you might recommend about the archaeology and the anthropology of Wisconsin early.
A lot of great potential sources. I would encourage you to visit the Wisconsin Archaeological Society. You can do a Yahoo or a Google search. The journal is the oldest continuously published professional journal of archaeology in eastern North America, if not potentially North America. It's been published since the turn of the century, since 1900. And there's a 1997 volume that is a summary written by various colleagues of mine, chapters, many of the traditions that we're covering in this program. 12 Millennia, The Archaeology of the Upper Mississippi River Valley by Jim Thieler and Ernie Robert Bozart, Iowa Press, University of Iowa Press is another great source that was published in the 2000s. The Indian Mounds book by Bob Birmingham and Leslie Eisenberg is a great source for later cultures that we're going to be covering later in this program. And those are some of the resources that I would look at. One older resource that was published in the early 1980s and reprinted again in the 2000s is Ron Mason, a professor emeritus of anthropology at Lawrence University's Great Lakes Archaeology. It's still quite up to date, even though it's getting close to 30 years old.
Interesting. Tom wonders if there's any indication of the use of ATEL?
Atlatls. Atlatls are spear throwers, and there is some indirect evidence for their use. There is some rock art in the southwestern part of the state that may be archaic in age that shows individuals' paintings or carvings, pictographs and petroglyphs of individuals with what look like atlatls or spear throwers. And then the spear thrower weights that were mentioned earlier, a caller called about birdstones and atlatl weights that suggest, along with some of the point types, that spear throwers were certainly used. We know they were likely used by Paleo-Indians, and I suspect that the technology was even improved upon during archaic times.
And Tom wonders in an email if there's J.W. wonders what happened to the climate around 400 B.C.
Well, we're approaching climatic conditions that are very similar today. I think the question implies, did that somehow cause the end of the archaic? What we'll talk about next time on this program is the woodland tradition, where we begin to see mound construction, the first use of pottery containers for cooking and storage, evidence of horticulture, the first gardening in the state. And those practices, cultural traits or cultural practices, are what archaeologists see in the archaeological record starting around 500 BC, maybe even several hundred years earlier than that. Certainly in Illinois and areas to the south, the woodland pattern emerges earlier. But it's the change in cultural practices in the archaeology that indicate a significant change in lifestyle. And climate may have had something to do with it, but it was probably also driven by increases in population, contact with cultures outside of Wisconsin, and also the increased complexity of the cultures that existed in our region and interaction with one another that led to these new technologies and new lifeways, which we'll explore next time.
Well, Tom, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm going to look for your next visit probably in about a month or so.
I don't know if we've established a date, but I'll look forward to it. And we'll talk about mound construction and the woodland tradition. And the Indian mounds are the most visible legacy in the archaeological record to the native prehistoric past in our region. But it's relatively recent, dating only to the last 2,500 years. And the number of sites increased dramatically in terms of our information here in Wisconsin.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Art.
Tom Plager is Dean of and Campus Executive Officer and an Associate Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at the UW-Baraboo Sauk County Campus. Really interesting programs as we talk about the anthropology and archaeology of the state. And definitely we'll be back. And next time we'll talk about We'll move on and talk about the woodland gatherers and take a look at that as well. I'm sorry we didn't get to everyone, but that's usually the way it works. But we're going to continue a little bit talking about Native Americans. We are zeroing in next on a statewide effort to bring attention to climate issues in Wisconsin. And our guest will be with us by phone. Jeff Crawford is the Forest County Pottawatomie Attorney General. So we'll look forward to that next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.